Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart, and you're listening to a Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. I had the chance this week to sit down with Republican gubernatorial candidate Rod Roberts for coffee. Hope you enjoy our conversation.
Okay, with Rod Roberts, gubernatorial candidate. So, 2 months out. Not quite even 2 months out.
We're under two, months,
under two
now.
Months out. So,
yay!
Well, yeah, home stretch, at least for the primary.
That's
Hopefully
right.
Hopefully you have longer to
exactly.
go after that. So.
Well, people will ask me, are you tired? Are you worn out yet? And I respond, 9 months after I began, I am as excited and energized as I have been at any point in the campaign based upon what I've discovered in 9 months of hard work. And that is the primary campaign process, which winnows out mm-hmm. candidates, allowed me the wonderful opportunity to emerge after the March 19th filing deadline as one of three candidates, and I'm happy to be the alternative new guy
yeah.
who's appeared with two better-known candidates, but if ever there was a year, 2010's the year to be a new leader who has emerged from the grassroots.
Definitely. I mean, because there's definitely a distinction between, you know, obviously with Branstad as well as with Vanderplaats, is that you appeal to both, in my opinion, to both fiscal and social conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see you as the true, you know, Reagan conservative mm-hmm. running in this race. What kind of response have you gotten? We were talking a little bit before we turned on the mic here about some of your county going around the different county several committees and
mm-hmm.
and the response you've gotten, as well as talking to manufacturers. So you want to mm-hmm. share a little bit about that?
Of course, in Iowa, you know, a statewide campaign is very grassroots intensive, mm-hmm. and Republicans expect candidates to show up and to show up frequently and then participate in an ongoing conversation, not only hearing you speak, but listening to them.
Mm-hmm.
And whether I've been up in Lyon County, far northwest corner, or down in Page County, and last week I was in both of those corners, northwest and southwest, or eastward. I find Republicans specifically, but Iowans generally, are very aware and very engaged in what's going on in politics and in government right now. And I believe that means 2010 is going to be a watershed election year. I've never seen people more energized, and by that I mean upset, frustrated and angry mm-hmm. about politics and people in positions of leadership and things that are going on. And so people are very willing to give you an earful and let you know what they're thinking.
Definitely.
And a candidate who is a good listener as well as a good speaker is, I think, well positioned to have an effective campaign and to be better prepared to serve in that leadership role once they're elected.
Well, you got the whole Tea Party movement. I know mm-hmm. I'm going to be going to the one in the Capitol tomorrow. Now you're heading to one tomorrow.
Spencer, Northwest Iowa. They've actually invited me to speak up
okay.
there, and that doesn't typically happen.
No,
happen
I was going to say, they absolutely said no, absolutely no elected officials speaking at the Capitol tomorrow. So.
And in Northwest Iowa, they very early asked me if I would consider being a speaker. And, of course, I'm not going there so much as a candidate campaigning as it is an invited guest to address all of them and speak about government. And certainly I'll talk about respect for the people, respect for the Constitution, and kind of where the grassroots is
yeah,
right now.
You made a little splash with the announcement regarding basically defending Iowa's sovereignty when mm-hmm. it came to the health care reform. What spurred that on?
We had, toward the end of session, a Health Reform Act bill in the Iowa legislature, and shortly after Congress passed the health insurance bill that President Obama then signed, we had this bill come up, and I filed an amendment onto the bill that actually contained two actions. Number one, it would establish the sovereignty of the state of Iowa under the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, stating that we will maintain our own authority and control over health insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
The second action then stated that within the state of Iowa, no citizen could be compelled to purchase a health insurance product mandated by the federal government. And so those two actions in that one amendment basically asserted the state's authority and its own sovereignty under the 10th Amendment. Had that amendment been adopted, if it had been passed and signed into law, we then would have had a statute mm-hmm. that would be in direct conflict with the federal statute, which would have provided the opportunity for a legal challenge. And as governor, I would have pushed that.
And yeah, you probably would have to do it on your own unless we get a new attorney general, which I'm hoping we will.
Yeah, and actually under the duties of the state attorney general, just by request of the governor or the general assembly or the executive council, the attorney general would have to take action. So it's not just a unilateral decision on the part of the attorney general.
Okay.
That person must also represent one of those three other entities within state government if requested.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you've been talking about corporate taxes and how you'd eliminate them, and you shared earlier a story about a company or a business owner that you were talking with. Would you want to recap that for those who are listening?
You know, here in Iowa, we've had a population of 3 million people for as long as I have lived here, and we have a population that continues to undergo dramatic changes, particularly in rural Iowa. A lot of our communities are experiencing an aging population, a declining workforce. We don't have families with young children living in numbers like we once did that provided strong support for local schools. And so I've been very concerned about job creation. And one of the primary issues for me in this gubernatorial campaign is what can we do to stimulate job creation by thousands of new jobs. And so in my campaign travels, I try and emphasize the importance of stopping and talking to local business leaders, and particularly manufacturing facilities, where what I've been able to uncover is that for a lot of these companies, medium-sized companies that may employ 200, 300 people, and they're a very important part of the economic stability of a given area, community, and a county, that elimination of the corporate income tax would, in fact, provide a powerful stimulus for them. They would take that additional revenue and they would reinvest it into expanding facilities, perhaps upgrading equipment, harnessing new technology. And every time I have brought that up, they've indicated that all those things would lead to hiring more people. And there was a particular business I visited in Southwest Iowa last week where the workforce is about 350, but they recently laid off 200 workers, and that might have been a year ago. And a lot of those workers are just patiently waiting for the call to come, we're going to hire you back. But that's not happened yet. But the individual acknowledged something like that would have a dramatic effect on their operations there and would help them make a decision to be able to hire back some of the folks who are unemployed. And, you know, with 110,000 Iowans out of work, it's about getting those people back to work, getting them back into the jobs they had, as well as creating new jobs for people.
Definitely. You've also said you would tackle, obviously, corporate income tax first, and then you tackle reducing, you know, the personal income tax. By how much do you think, and how kind of a time frame are you looking at if you were to be elected?
Of course, a governor serves a 4-year term, and I'm confident in my plan to eliminate the corporate income tax that it would provide a powerful stimulus to our state's economy, and we would create thousands of new jobs. That, in turn, will help us work through our budget process, our budget problem. We've got a situation now where declining revenue without any significant business expansion, no source of new revenue coming to the state, has put the squeeze on state government.
So you don't just raid other funds?
You can. It's all gone. They've been doing it. Governor Culver's been doing that the last couple of years to where there's nothing left.
Oh, then you just increase taxes, right?
Nope. That's the last thing you do. You do not raise taxes. In fact, someone asked me, do you think Iowans are paying too much in taxes? Yes. Next question. The answer is yes. But I think when you provide that powerful stimulus to the economy and thousands of new jobs are created, the benefit is the rising tide kicks in and all boats begin to rise, even including revenue to the state of Iowa. I think that helps us get our expenditures and revenue back in alignment and provides the surplus that I think we ought to send back to the taxpayers and provide individuals and families their own stimulus that then indirectly will benefit particularly small businesses, because mm-hmm. that's where a lot of that additional discretionary income would be spent. You know how those dollars turn over mm-hmm. in a local community. And rather than the government trying to centrally plan and stimulate the economy, it's about government getting away from that role, stepping back and saying, let's just have a friendly business environment. Let's let people use their resources and stimulate the economy. I think we'd be amazed at the results here.
Iowa's got a horrible business climate. I can't remember what we were ranked. I saw that. No, it was
depends on who's doing the ranking, but some of them have us close to the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty bad. So I know Northwest Iowa is losing jobs to
South Dakota
all the time.
Well, and you know, perception is reality, because you can tout, you know, an article here or somebody's survey there, but the overall impression of Iowa is that it's not a business-friendly state. So how do you overcome that? I think we could dramatically send a signal that says we've done an about-face. We're serious now about a business climate that will be welcoming to new business. We not only want to encourage our existing businesses, but we want new companies coming to Iowa. Mm-hmm. And that'd be a priority with me and my time and resources as governor of Iowa.
So just, you know, the iJobs, you know, I know Governor Culver's been, you know, throwing all this
misguided and wrong.
But we're, you know, got all these nice public jobs that he suddenly had to cut back on, so.
Mm-hmm. And these precious resources that we could have used, like for our local schools, mm-hmm. he's now diverting to paying off these bonds, you know, where we're going to be on the hook for a total of almost $1.7 billion in principal and interest over 20 years. And what really irritates Iowans, because we're a proud people and a frugal people, we're accustomed to paying our own way, paying our own bills, this bill's being sent to our children and grandchildren. And that really has Iowans worked up about this. And Governor Culver didn't do one thing to stimulate job creation in the private sector when he had the opportunity to work with the legislature this session.
But, you know, someone said, but, you know, Representative Roberts, are you against flood recovery? I mean, you know, because they're helping out people in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. You know,
that's a separate issue from bonding. We had an economic emergency fund as part of our cash reserve accounts, and the economic emergency fund, which had approximately, since we put 2.5% of our reserves there, close to $150 million. The idea of putting money aside into an account like that is you've got the cash to work with.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to go. It's not to borrow and bond, but that's what Chet Culver has had to do in his opinion, because he's used up all this one-time money and spent all these cash reserve funds in other areas of state government.
Representative Gronsdahl.
Senator,
thank you. Like I said, 3 hours of sleep last night. So he said, you know, well, our bond rating's better than, you know, our situation's better than other states. You know, how would you respond to that?
I hate the comparison stuff. Why are we always compared against somebody else's standard? Why don't we set the standard? And most Iowans hear a statement like that and they go, you know, that doesn't matter. It's what you're doing. We don't agree with this. The fact that you believe you can borrow your way to prosperity and economic growth is a failed policy. It doesn't work. Iowans intuitively know that's a false premise. It doesn't matter what our bond ratings are. And you've heard the line that even Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had great bond ratings,
yeah,
you know, before that meltdown took place. I don't think it's appropriate to use as a politically rhetorical comment that at least it's not as bad as other places. People don't like that comparison contrast. They want us dealing with our situation, and why not position Iowa to be different than everybody else and to be fiscally sound?
And that would be attract people to the state as well.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, we just completed probably the best thing about this last legislative session is that it's done.
Done. 79 days, which proves a point. We can do it in less time. And I've been an advocate of maybe looking at, you know, reevaluating session. You could perhaps consider a biennial session of the General Assembly. You could certainly look at shortened session time, because you proved that in 79 days, mm-hmm. whether you like the budget that was passed, they in fact could get a budget put together and passed, and they could have other policy debates and then legislation passed in the confines of 80 days. Well, that's a tremendous savings to the taxpayers, mm-hmm. to have a shortened session.
Absolutely. So what out of these 79 days, what legislation just kind of put a burr under your saddle that, you know, it's like, I can't believe that got through, that we need to address other than the budget?
To tell you the truth, this, in my 10 years in the legislature, it was the least productive. It was the least, I think, valuable to the people of Iowa in terms of time spent, decisions made, of any of the 10 years I've been in the legislature. The only thing noteworthy that I believe had support from Republicans and Democrats alike was the initiative to try and reorganize state government, make state government more efficient, cost-effective. The irony in all that, for all the time spent, the savings were maybe in the neighborhood of $70 million. We're at the tail end of session with debate on the large omnibus standing appropriations bill. The new spending that came in at the tail end exceeded the savings in the reorganization bill. So if there anyone had any hopes of something positive or the silver lining, that was dashed by all the additional pork barrel spending at the end.
I could point out one thing that, you know, we could say is positive. It's bipartisan. It's now we don't allow minors to strip in Iowa.
Yeah, there you go.
So there.
There you go.
You can hold on to that.
Yeah, we'll take that one.
That is like my little personal crusade this session, because I thought that was the only way I was going to get through.
There you go. That will work.
And some people will say, well, we don't allow texting while we're driving now, too, which...
There's another.
I didn't see how you voted on that. What's the final
version? I voted no.
Okay.
Out of conference committee, partly because, you know, you start to make a distinction in age groups, and once you begin to take a simple idea and you begin to expand that and make exceptions and provisions, then I think you were better off backing up. And the original debate was whether you limit action or go to a more broad, general, distracted driver piece of legislation. And when you start carving out exceptions, you know, then I don't know that you've accomplished the good you set out to accomplish. Obviously, the public would like those things addressed, and I had been supportive early on. But that final version out of the conference committee and its report, I didn't think we had the good. We certainly made the good product that I had hoped to, and so I voted no. Which is always a judgment call at the end, because you always qualify with people, I've got to see the final version before I know whether I'm yes or no on an issue that early on might be simple, but by the end of the legislative process might have morphed into something entirely different, such as the ban on texting while driving bill. So,
it's still amazing that people even try to do that. But
in your travels, you see people do a lot of odd behaviors.
Well, I'm thinking too, what's next? I mean, you know, they're going to start, you know, they're going to pass a law, no eating while you're driving,
that's where you're going to go. You talk about a distracted driver piece of legislation that is an omnibus thing, or you narrow it to a very specific thing, like we started out with.
Yeah, I was going to say, people wouldn't want me driving if I couldn't drink coffee.
Well, at least I don't think you'd read a newspaper. I've seen people do that. And you're certainly not going to be putting on makeup. You might shave with an electric razor. Yeah. I hope not, but potentially I could see you doing something like that, I guess. But you've seen it all.
Yeah.
If you've been on the road, you probably have, like I have. You just go, I can't believe they were doing that.
And the thing is, we already have laws that if they got, obviously you want to prevent accidents, but if they're caught doing that, I mean, there's already laws on the books that could handle that.
Yes.
Anyway, you know,
that's right.
I'm just thinking where, you know, that's going to end up leading to a further nanny state, or, you know.
Well, that's the concern. By the time you cobble up something, it's kind of like, you know, now we have our tentacles into so many different areas where then we've decided it will apply to you, but we give you special dispensation and it won't cover you.
Yeah.
That's problematic. And that's part of the reason why I voted no in the end.
It's kind of like, you know, the smoking ban. On one hand, as a non-smoker, I'm really enjoying, you know, non-smoking environments. But on the other hand, too, it's like, you know, businesses should be able to decide that for themselves.
Yes.
Anyway, that was last year, but obviously one of the big elephants in the room that legislature like kept avoiding this year was the gay marriage debate. Mm-hmm. There's a distinction between you and Bob Vanderplas as far as executive order. What are your thoughts on
that? Well, I believe that the branches of government are separate. I don't like to use the word equal because I think that the Constitution grants different and unique powers or authorities to the three branches of government.
Checks and balances.
And balances, and they are separate. I believe that the executive branch of government, its role is to implement and execute the laws passed by the General Assembly, which is the lawmaking body. Typically, that's done through promulgation of rules, where you take the law and hopefully abide by the intent of what the legislature meant, and then you implement and enforce those laws. Executive orders are an instrument that the governor, who is the chief official within the executive branch of government, can use to direct certain action within the executive branch or prevent or say no to certain action. But it applies to the executive branch when it comes to executing and implementing the law. That authority does not go over into either of the other two branches. So I disagree with Mr. Vanderplas on the executive order. I do not believe that he can put a stay on a court ruling and tell them that their branch has no effect with what I think is their constitutional role, interpret law in light of the Constitution.
And they can strike down law, obviously.
Yes. As governor, I think the proper recourse would be, I would immediately go to the General Assembly and say, the courts ruled something to be unconstitutional. Let's take this matter up. Let's address it, especially something as important as marriage.
Yeah. Okay. We were talking about the gay marriage ruling, and a question came to mind. Bob Vanderplas's argument kind of centers around the term chief magistrate and how he defines that. How do you define that?
Chief magistrate is a synonym for governor. It's another way of expressing that the highest ranking official within the executive branch of government is the governor, or he is the chief of all magistrates or people who enforce law. I don't interpret that to mean he has superpowers that extend beyond the executive branch into the other branches of government. I think it's bad public policy to, in fact, place that much power and authority in one individual.
I mean, I was just thinking if the roles were reversed and it were, Governor Colbert doing something, let's say we passed 99% limitation, and he said, no, suddenly the courts ruled against a good law, and he said, I'm going to place an executive order against that, or say, Barack Obama at the national level.
Yeah.
I mean, we wouldn't like it.
No, absolutely. And I just don't think the Constitution provides for that kind of authority within that chief magistrate or the governor of the state of Iowa. And people need to understand that the ruling the court came down with last year, and some would say, well, it's bound to happen anyway. But that whole process was expedited because of legislation passed in 2007 that at the time was called the anti-bullying legislation. It was significant civil rights legislation. That set the stage for this entire episode to unfold.
Absolutely.
And some of us at the time knew just how dangerous that was going to be.
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
When they're looking at what most people still deem a behavior and giving that protective status, and having been a youth pastor and worked in schools and still work with kids and when I was growing up, I'm wondering, where's the anti-bullying law for the fat, pudgy white kids like myself when I was in elementary
school? I served on a school board, historically, traditionally, school boards and their policy are the law of the land.
Yeah.
And they do not allow bullying. And if you have a bully, you deal with that bully.
I was bullied in elementary school. I was like, where's my law?
Yeah, exactly. And it had nothing to do with that, actually. It was all just cover for, I believe, a larger agenda and a much more proactive agenda on the part of people pushing, the gay and homosexual agenda that set us up for this court ruling on marriage. I think it was all premeditated. Mm-hmm. People need to realize elections have consequences. Governor Culver and majority Democrats did what their party deems to be important and a priority by way of public policy. Mm-hmm. So elections have consequences. These people were part of a political group that said this matters, this needs to be advanced, and they did it.
Yeah.
And we live with the fallout. And even though I might not like it, you might not like it, Bob Vanderplas doesn't like it, fact of the matter is you can't change the Constitution midstream to all of a sudden say we want the rules different for us. Because you're right, there could come a day where what you've done at this moment could come back to haunt you later on when somebody different occupies the office.
Yeah, definitely. Constitutional conventions, then, you know, that's going to be on the ballot as well. What are your thoughts on that?
I somewhat take the role of a civics teacher at this point. I neither advocate for or against, but I think it's important to make citizens aware that that question appears on the ballot, just like I think it's important to let citizens know about the retention election with three of our justices this November. So I try to explain to people that question's on the ballot. It has positives and it has drawbacks. Here they are. I really don't know how to call that, but what I do know is the Constitution provides it to the people. And this is a matter that the people get to decide at the ballot. And I think it's inappropriate for elected officials or anyone else to say, oh, we shouldn't do that. It's fraught with peril. I'd say pity the poor fool who thinks they could mess with the people's constitutional convention if, in fact, the people said, we want one.
Well, I think if we end up getting one, it's going to be due to the marriage issue. And,
yes.
And if anybody troubles to obstruct that.
Mm-hmm. At their peril.
At their peril.
The people will rise up and do something.
And, you know, and polls have still shown that Iowa is still a center-right state, so I don't think we're going to get, you know, having our right to work law struck down or, you know, entitlement spending.
And any resolution that would be advanced in the Constitutional Convention would ultimately have to go to a vote of the people anyway.
Absolutely.
So nobody gets to enact anything or impose anything on the will of the people if the people themselves haven't approved in, you know, amending the Constitution directly.
So. Some just see it as a, you know, another tool, like Robinson, an Iowa Republican's big fan of that. Yeah, you know, I'm thinking it's interesting.
I'm not against it, but I'm not advocating for it either. I think it's there, and the citizens should know it's there. And I wish that there would be groups as interested in advancing, you know, here's this on the ballot, like the retention election, like you ought to be concerned about the executive order. Some are very passionate, but they kind of ignore these other things that are immediately available to the people. And I'm all about making sure that people are informed and aware of what their rights are by way of the authority vested in them by the Constitution. Because ultimately, as the Constitution in Iowa declares, all political power is inherent within the people themselves. And ultimately, that's what I respect and acknowledge. And if the people want to take matters up on their own, so be it. I'm all for that.
Great. Let's see. Now, you mentioned, okay, you would extend the legislative session. Anything else the governor could do to address this? And then I'll give you one chance to answer that, and then we'll probably move on.
Well, I tell you what. The governor of a state occupies a tremendous bully pulpit. And I watched with interest how our current governor prepared for that moment where I believe he led people to believe he would do something proactively to resist or to fight back a ruling like that. And as soon as the ruling was made known, I could tell very quickly that he was vacillating. And then when he came out with his formal response several days later, he basically flip-flopped on this issue. And that is not leadership. Right then and there, I knew people of Iowa deserve better in a governor than this, because I thought we were set up.
Well, now he's even backing it and saying that I don't know what polling he's saying, but says the majority of Iowans are in favor of this ruling. I'm like, what? The Iowa poll didn't say that. You know, they asked whether it affects your daily life, and if they asked me that, no.
But do I agree with this? Yeah, the answer is no. Traditional marriage is the way that the law should read it on.
Yeah, I'm afraid how it might impact my kids down the road.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So, speaking of kids, and I know your time is limited here, so I just want to ask you, just education, you know, the Des Moines Public Schools having to cut a bunch of teaching positions, and it's similar, you know, things are happening across the state, different school districts. Would you speak to that, the education cuts that have happened? I know that kind of dovetails with, you know, the spending reform
taxes. Actually, people still highly value their local schools, and that matters to communities, regardless of whether it's the Des Moines metropolitan area or a rural community. We still value and highly prize those local school districts. The fact that certain decisions and choices were made about spending money that didn't prioritize local public schools is a reflection of our current governor and his, what I consider, misplaced priorities. You had the second highest amount of general fund spending in state history. And yet the governor believes that his iJobs borrowing and bonding program is more important than providing adequate funds for local schools. So he's made a choice, and that choice is costing local school districts revenue that they otherwise would have had, where they could have continued providing the salaries for teachers. I think most Iowans have concluded that regardless of the rhetoric from Governor Culver, his priority is different from the majority of Iowans. Iowans expect state government to focus on public security, which means law enforcement, corrections, access to justice, and then you got to take care of education, which means schools, and human services to the best of our ability, meaning you take care of people who have needs that they can't provide for themselves. That's where you want your elected officials to concentrate their time, effort, and the people's resources. I think Governor Culver, as is the tendency of a big government kind of governor, would rather create new programs and stretch thin resources into additional areas where, quite frankly, the people say, we don't want that. Focus on the priorities. Give us adequate funding for our schools, because that matters to our local communities.
Great. And just one last question is, you've been campaigning for a while. What's been one of the favorite things that's happened to you or that you've experienced while doing this?
Actually, it's just the statewide response to somebody new who has emerged. You know, I've always understood that when you serve as a legislator from a geographically defined area where people know you well in your home district, but as you travel, people discover you for the first time. And it's been one of those pleasant experiences as people have met me. They've said, you know what? That guy can be the governor. Mm-hmm. And that's where this grassroots interest and support has come from all over Iowa. People who meet me and listen, and whom I have a chance to listen to, have been extremely supportive. And I've made new friends all over Iowa. No matter, you know, where I'm at, there are people who believe that it's time for a new conservative governor. And they know the other two gentlemen in the Republican primary race very well. And yet a whole lot of people are very open-minded about somebody new and different this time around. And that's what encourages me as I continue in this campaign. I think I'll be the surprise candidate on June 8th.
Okay. Well, I know some people were saying, you know, especially after the debate, oh, it seems like there was, I know crusty conservatives said, oh, there was a love thing going on between, you know, Governor Branstad and Rod Roberts, that he's just trying to get a lieutenant governor spot. No, that's not the case.
Nobody runs to be the spoiler. Nobody runs for second fiddle or lieutenant governor. It doesn't exist. Nobody gives this much of their time, or one's family gives this much time, just to do it for fun and for second place. I'm out to win. I think I can win on June 8th. And whatever happens after June 8th, time will tell. But at this point, it's full steam ahead, because I actually believe in my heart of hearts. I've done so much in 9 months, traveled so far across Iowa, met so many people. And right now, with less than 2 months to go, I'd have to say that momentum is certainly on my side. People are interested in somebody new, and in politics, position, timing, and momentum matter. And you want to capture that at the right time. And I think 2 months out, June 8th looks like the perfect time to peak. And that's what I intend to do.
Absolutely. And then hopefully you keep going.
That's right. So. Yep, into the general election. I actually believe in the general campaign I will carry a very compelling conservative message to all Iowans, and I will attract independent registered voters and at least the conservative Democrats. And Chet Culver knows I can do that because I've proven it over and again, election after election. I believe I pose the single greatest threat to Chet Culver's re-election bid. I'm the candidate he fears running against in November. And so I know I can take the race to him, and I can beat him in November.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Shane.